Well, hey there. This is Endeavors. Episode 5. On the show today, we have author Sam Weeb, as well as filmmaker Rob Connolly, and musician and poet C.R. Avery. That's all coming up on Endeavor.
Promiscuous women.
My first guest is an author based here in Vancouver who won the Arthur Ellis Award and the Kobo Emerging Writer Prize for his first novel, Last of the Independents. He has a new book out, which is the first in a series of mystery novels starring the character David Wakeland. It is Invisible Dead, and he is Sam Weeb, and I talked to him earlier this summer. This is a very interesting book, and I think, you know, for listeners and for readers who live in Vancouver, it will hit home for a lot of them in many ways. Where did the original idea for this book come from?
Well, I started writing it in 2012, which it was around the time of the Opal Commission, you know, the commission for looking into the murdered missing women inquiry. And as that was going on, I was, you know, talking to people who were sort of involved in that, people who had worked in the sex trade or, you know, law enforcement and journalists and people who had, you know, done research on that. And talking to everyone, I was amazed by how much wasn't ending up in the inquiry, how many, you know, voices weren't being heard and how different the official narrative was from what, you know, what I was hearing. And, you know, I think that that's really where the impetus came from, was just to sort of show what's really going on or what, you know, people might not be thinking about.
Well, you bring up a very interesting point because, you know, obviously that commission and that whole case is very well known in Vancouver, but there seems to be a lot that the general public, you know, still don't know. When you were doing research for your book, you know, how much did you discover that you didn't actually know about the case? You know, like what was being said sort of in the media versus what you may have found out that people didn't necessarily want to come out.
Well, I think, you know, the biggest thing for me and really the biggest, point still is that people think of that as you know, the Picton case, or you know, like they frame it around one serial killer, and you know, Vancouver has had several killers who targeted the same demographic, the same group, predominantly poor, marginalized people of color who work in the sex trade. So once you're sort of aware of that, it really shifts things away from, you know, the narrative of, you know, it took a long time, but thank God we caught him, right? That's such an insufficient and I think really false and damaging way of framing that. So that's really the biggest point, I think.
So, you know, about the novel, you decided to tell the story through the eyes of a private investigator, Dave Wakeland. What made you decide to go that route in specifically?
Well, there's two things. One, I grew up really loving, you know, the tradition of the detective novel. You know, going back to Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, you know, up to Sue Grafton and Robert B. Parker, and that whole tradition I really love. You know, just in literature, you know, the private eye is a figure that can move through classes and groups in society, and you know, sort of works as someone who can, you know, see into the different social strata. So I really like that. And also, I really didn't want to write a police procedural. I thought it was important to, you know, not have the protagonist involved with the police, at least in the story.
You know, given the subject matter of the book, was it easier or harder for you to write about your hometown in a sense?
You know, it's weird. I love Vancouver, and you know, when I started writing the book, I'd finished school, I was working at a college, and I was, you know, just going out and walking around the city and really rediscovering it. And you know, at the same time, doing all this research and sort of seeing what's going on beneath that and how other people see it. So there was a real ambivalence. And I think that that's what's really in the book, you know, that I do love Vancouver, but it's got some real issues that it hasn't really confronted.
So what I read that was really interesting is that someone just compared you to David Simon. I happen to think that comparison's quite apt given the sort of The Wire-esque type of story that The Invisible Dead is. What does that mean to you to be compared to somebody like him?
Well, we're both bald. obviously I love The Wire and you know, Treme and The Corner and all of his shows. You know, going back to Homicide, I mean, I grew up as a kid watching Homicide, Life on the Street, and NYPD Blue. And what was so great about those shows is that they showed law enforcement as a job, right? They showed it as, something that can be done well, but something that ultimately is, that's a workplace. And when that idea of a workplace, when that comes into contact with things like poverty or drugs or the sex trade or you know, just the idea of justice, there's a real antagonism between that. And, that's hopefully what I could, put into the book.
Why do you think, you know, issues like the sex trade or a murdered woman, and specifically the case surrounding Vancouver, why do you think people are so uncomfortable in maybe talking about it?
You know, in some ways, I don't think they are uncomfortable with talking about it. I think that everyone sort of has this knowingness of, oh, you know, it's this person's fault, or it's this, you know, and part of it is just getting people to stop and realize that, you know, they actually don't know what's going on, including me. You know, I'm as ignorant as anyone else. So I think that that's really what's important, is just kind of getting people to listen and maybe be more open to another perspective on that.
You know, on that note, like there's as we said before, there's been so much talked about in this case, you know, from the courts or from the police. But what do you think a fictional perspective can tell us about this story or this case?
Well, that's a good question.
So what do you think a fictionalized perspective can tell us about this case?
Well, I think, you know, narrative is something that we look for in the news. And even if you just look at the stories around like movies and movie grosses, you know, that people sort of, if they don't get the narrative from the movie, they're going to create their own, you know, around, you know, whether the movie's a success or not. So given that we have this kind of desire for narrative and drama, I think it can be really useful to show something on a small scale that can, you know, sort of stand for something bigger. You know, in the book, in Invisible Dead, you know, I just focus on one person, one missing woman. And I hope that that's a way to sort of elucidate some of the issues surrounding that topic in a way that, you know, is interesting and that makes people think, but that doesn't sort of overwhelm them.
Yeah. What do you, I mean, definitely in the last couple of years, we've started having a conversation about missing women or, you know, indigenous and aboriginal rights. What do you make of how far we've come in terms of addressing those concerns?
Oh man, I mean, I'm not an expert on that. I would just say that, you know, I grew up, I'm a product of the BC school system, and, you know, I learned nothing about colonialism, First Nations, you know, any of the cultures that were here first. You know, last year, the UBC Museum of Anthropology ran an exhibit called Sesnam, the City Before the City, and it just blew my mind that there is so much, you know, we'd never been told. And, you know, to have things like residential school narratives come out, I mean, this is really important stuff. You know, as far as reconciliation, again, like, I'm not someone who would feel comfortable making suggestions and that stuff, but just that it has to start with a respectful education, you know, just of our history. I think, you know, that's important for us, for everyone who lives here.
And, you know, given now that you're an award-winning crime novelist, what maybe nugget of advice would you offer young writers out there, or, you know, or young people that are interested in sort of the crime fiction?
You know, when I started writing my first book, Last of the Independents, I heard all sorts of perceived wisdom, you know, things like, don't set your books in Canada, don't write about private eyes, don't show violence towards animals, don't put children in danger. And, you know, my first book did all of those things. You know, there's a great piece of advice that the screenwriter William Goldman has, which is, nobody knows anything. You know, everyone who presents themselves as an expert about what people will like, you know, it's always going to be false. What people respond to, I think, is just honesty and good writing. And, you know, whatever that is for you, you just have to go for it. And, you know, don't worry about the money, because there is none.
Well, Invisible Dead is certainly good writing. Sam Weeb, thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you.
Alrighty, I encourage all the listeners, all the readers, to go out there and get The Invisible Dead. And Sam's going to be, you have an event on the 6th, I believe. You're going to be at Black Bonds Books in Maple Ridge on the 6th, and then the one Black Bonds in Surrey on the 13th. You can go to samweeb.com for that. Sam Weeb, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ciao. That was my conversation with author Sam Weeb. And now we have a track off of C.R. Avery's album, All the Angels Didn't Scare Me. This is Promiscuous Women.
Smoking till I made cigarettes. I know no
And that was Promiscuous Women by C.R. Avery. Well, C.R. Avery is a poet, writer, and musician from Vancouver. He has collaborated with Shane Coizen and Mighty Mike McGee on the Talk Rock project, Tons of Fun University. Most recently, he released his album, All the Angels Didn't Scare Me. He spent a couple of months touring the States, and he's just starting a tour across Canada. He is C.R. Avery, so here is our conversation. I'm thrilled to be joined by Vancouver's poet laureate, C.R. Avery. Hello.
Hello, good sir.
I sort of gave you that introduction, but you're a bit of a rock star in the Vancouver, I guess, music underground poetry scene, however you want to describe it. What is that like for you, sort of representing a city or at least a certain section of the place where you live?
Well, I mean, I've used the phrase rockstar parking in my time, but as a whole, I hate the phrase rockstar. I think it's when it all died. Rock and roll has always been like the circus on the outskirts of town. And just that mentality of being an idiot does not appeal to me at all. To me, rock and roll was just folk music played really loud. And it was anti-everything. It had a giant heart. And so... So that's what I focus on, is doing that.
You know, I saw your stuff on the website. I think it, you know, describes you as punk piano player, folky, spoken word guru. How would you describe yourself and then what you do?
I mean, a carpenter or a truck driver. I mean, at the end of the day, sometimes we get people to write resumes because people ask for it. But as a whole, defining yourself is pretty silly. I mean, there's a poet named Patricia Smith. I'm out in New York from Chicago. She wrote a poem about me after we met at a show at a university. Lately, I've just been using that for a bio, and I actually got in trouble. It was a poetry magazine that asked me to contribute, and then I did. You know, we all need the work. It was paid work, and then they were like, you know, we'll choose these three of the five you sent, and they said, please send a bio, and I sent this poem that it's short. It's like a little beautiful paragraph. And they're like, could you please send us something less poetic, kind of snarky? And I'm like, I'm not running for office. I'm not even a sports person. It's not a coffee shop. You're running a fucking poetry magazine. And I sent you a poem. Like, what the hell do you, like, what the hell? And I just stopped writing them back, and I'm like, how square are you? If you're on a poetry magazine, you're telling me to send you a straight bio. But then they just wrote a shitty review of my book instead. But yeah, people get funny with that stuff. I don't want to, hopefully, I mean, if you ask someone, they're going to say, you know, he's an asshole, and you're like, talk to somebody else and then go, oh yeah, I saw him do spoken word. Yeah, somebody else, I saw him do burlesque. Like, I can't worry about that stuff.
You know, I think Vancouver is probably one of the strongest spoken word poetry scenes in the country, at least anyway.
That's debatable.
Fair enough. But the I think a lot of...
And I don't say that negatively. Yeah. I mean, I'm from the East, and I came West, and the only reason I started doing spoken word is because that's where all the gigs were at. And there was a beautiful movement happening. And it's had many ups and downs, but that's like every city. For a while, Saskatoon was just on fire. It was the best gig, the best audiences, the best pay. The best host, and then in Toronto, it had a golden era as well. So, and then before that, we never even toured Canada. Canada had no spoken word scene, and all we did was do the States. But it's like anything; it's like a neighborhood before it gets gentrified. There's a little window. Yeah. Could I get a glass of water, boss?
You know, it's. We were talking a little bit before the interview about gentrification and sort of the history of the place, the Rock Joe's. And earlier today, I actually read an article about the city trying to change the name of Hastings Sunrise to East Village. I don't know if you've heard about this. And there was a petition started with four words: "We are not New York." What do you make of that?
Well, New York's not New York. I mean, you have Spike Lee screaming on CNN going, you stole Harlem. You stole Harlem. I mean, I listen to Jay-Z, and he's talking about this, like, you know, slum projects he grew up in, and then I get a text when I'm in New York from my friend, like, come meet me at this cool coffee shop, and it's the same neighborhood. But I think Patti Smith said it best when she played CBGB's last gig. It's a building. It's a building. And so we have to be gypsies. And, you know, like Neil Young says, it's easy to get buried in the past when you're trying to make a good thing last. You grab the joy as it flies, and then you move.
You know, and I think, going back to what we were saying earlier about I think spoken word or slam poetry, I think if you were to ask perhaps the general public, they might have a difficult time describing exactly what that is. So how would sort
but
of
for
you
me
break
the
it down?
General public, when you say country and western, a lot of people think new country. That's not what country means to me. You know, there was the whole caricature of Beatnik with the funny hat and the sunglasses.
Yeah,
thank you, brother. That's not, you know, even beat poetry doesn't even resonate with me. You say hip hop, and people have a stereotypical view of that. So again, like I said, the good stuff is always on the outskirts of town, and you can't let other people define that.
You know, why do you think it is, as someone who's, you know, prominent in this scene, there's the idea that artists, all stripes, tend to gather in specific parts of any given city or any given town. Why do you think that is?
Well, artists like to have a lot of sex, so it's good to have a lot of other artists around. I mean, I would not be doing, I'm a musician, I wouldn't have done spoken word unless I lived in this neighborhood. Bob Dylan said he wouldn't have wrote any of the songs that he wrote in those first 10 years if he didn't live in New York City. Those wouldn't have been written in Minnesota. You know, to think, you know, the last 3 years doing the burlesque musical, that wouldn't have happened if I lived in Toronto. But the truth is, to be able to go and see other shows and be inspired and get ideas, that's part of the joy of choosing this profession. Watching musicians bleed their instruments, watching new heights of what you didn't think was possible. You want to be around a creative atmosphere. And then sometimes you're like, okay, and then you head out to the hills to pull it all together. Artists like to be around other artists. But my first answer was more honest.
Yeah, it's one of the best answers and true answers I think I've heard. So how would you describe your writing, your artistic process? Are you regimented in how you go about it, or do you just be like, hey, that thing's cool, let me just jot this down?
I think everybody writes. Like, you write.
Yeah.
I never dated a woman that didn't keep a journal, that didn't take notes. I mean, I tour with a band. None of them are writers per se, but they all scribble in a book, or if they're just taking notes, like, oh, I'm gonna check out this artist, and then they'll put a little side note. Like, we all write, and I just think some of us enjoy that so much that we try to delve in. And so that if we're gonna actually show people those notes, have it really say what we're thinking. Just like all kids draw. When do we lose? Like every kid. It's like, oh, what do we do with Johnny? Oh, we'll give him a piece of paper and some coloring, and he'll draw. And then we just stop. But some people don't.
Speaking of bands, is there a future for Tons of Fun University, or is that project sort of in the past now, would you say?
Well, I mean, it is in the past, but no one's OD'd on heroin, and the group never broke up. I've always been inspired by Neil. I mean, I already quoted him once in our chat. He just, things run their course, and he's just got to keep the creative juices flowing, but then every once in a while, like, he'll write something that actually suits Crosby, Stills, and Nash. You know, he'll write something, and no, it's time for Crazy Horse. So, you know, so it's never dead. You're really at the mercy of the song. I love those two boys, and always will.
You've mentioned, you know, Neil Young a couple of times, and I think when you're sort of talking about Canadian musicians, Canadian writers, he's one of the big three.
I wouldn't even do the Canadian.
Just writers in general.
You know, there's people that go out to make money, that live in a suburban existence, and then there's people that just have to create. You never know with Neil if he's going to even play a song that you know. And he made that decision a long time ago. And he could have made a lot more money playing it straight, but that's just not what he does. Dylan doesn't need any more money. And people don't even recognize the song, even when he's playing a song they know, because he's rewritten it. There's just a few cats that just... this is what they do, and they're going to do it until they physically can't. And that's inspiring. As we hit the crossroads of middle age, just to go, no, you don't have to turn into a caricature of yourself. You just keep writing, keep keeping it new.
So, ultimately, how would you describe what art is and what being an artist is?
Oh, God, man. Well, I would say this. Let's say I'm in a zone and I'm painting. I walk into this room, and it's like, damn, that's a badass green. And go, oh, if you look a little closer, it's kind of covered in flowers. Or if I'm trying to do an effect with, like, white sky with the tree branches where they look kind of ghostly, then I'm looking at all the branches that way as I walk home going, if I don't want to put a lot of detail, what's a little trick in there? Or if I have to do the detail. And so I'm looking at the world in a visual curiosity. And if I'm in a writing zone, and I love one line, but I can't find the rhyme for it. And then someone says something, there it is. And so for me, if it anything, it just makes your life exquisite. Because if you don't have those things, you're not looking at the branches that way. You're not listening to conversation the same way.
You know, we were talking a little bit before the interview about the political history surrounding where we are right now, and it's such a just weird political time in the world. You've got the Black Lives Matter movement, you've got whatever's happening in the Middle East, you've got Trump. How important is that as an artist, as a storyteller, as a performer, to intersect arts and politics?
I mean, another line that I love from Bob is, all propaganda is phony. And once Marvin Gaye, when asked, how could you write What's Going On? And then, you know, 4 months later, put out Sexual Healing. And he responded like, sometimes I look out my window and I watch the TV and it's heartbreaking. Where we stand as a universe. And sometimes I get horny. I can't force anything. I can't go, oh, I need to write something political. Or I need to write something to appeal to the ladies or to the men. Because then, to me, you have an agenda. Now, sometimes I will go, I need to tackle this, rather a personal thing that I haven't dealt with. Or if I'm willing to write a country ballad, if this is my craft, if I write songs, how come I haven't wrote something about 49 people that were gunned down? I think like a bird in the city builds a nest that is some branches, but some of it's garbage. And our set has to have a little garbage in it because we don't live in the forest. And our nest is going to have a little bit of a chip bag in there and maybe even a dirty condom.
If you could offer perhaps one piece of advice to a young one out there who maybe wants to be a musician or a writer or a storyteller of some form, could you give them any of your wisdom?
Wisdom's a funny word. Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky one. Like, for me, just being in the presence of some old schoolers really felt good. Like that, maybe that's another reason we all come to the city and congregate. There's not really a straight roadmap to do this. You know, if you're going to be a doctor, maybe you're not going to get accepted into a Canadian university and you might have to go abroad. But as a whole, you finish a schooling and then you have the paperwork and you can be a doctor. In the arts, all we really have is legend stories of the people that we listen to and are inspired by. And then that we still see people that are older that are doing it. And then we go, so I think if anyone's advice, the person that was serious, be like, no, where can I get a gig in Regina? Because it's tricky. That would be a more honest question. Or I think that's the only honest question, because everything else is just, you do it. But I get it. Like, sometimes it's just nice to be around other people that are doing it or have been doing it a while. I love the old writers.
Well, this has been a very fun conversation.
Yeah, bro.
Thanks, CR, man.
That was my conversation with CR Avery, and now here's his song, Saint Catherine.
.42, she unbuttoned my shirt while a rapper in the other room kept the party going. Behind closed doors, she gave me pleasure, emptied the safe like a thief tipped on. In the dark, the birthmark of a friend's bed, we woke the dead as boats began to ricochet. Security with his fake ID, got an alibi for county fair. and I growled as my thumb made you hum. Deep and low over the radio scented bouquet. Sweet lady, I hope to see you again someday. Afternoon for natural born killers, even with this killer soundtrack. So we turned it off and disappeared, like two spirits haunting a shotgun shack. Wasn't sure if we should begin it with only 15 minutes to have Catherine sainted in the painted shadows of Rembrandt and Monet. But I'm sure glad we did, sweet lady. And I hope to see you again someday. I hope to see you again. I hope to see you again someday.
My final guest just made his feature film directorial debut with Joel Kinnaman from The Killing and Tom Holland from The New Spider-Man. The film is The Edge of Winter. His name is Rob Connolly. Here is our conversation. I am joined on the phone by author Sam Weeb. His new book is The Invisible Dead. Sam, hello. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is a very interesting book, and I think, you know, for listeners and for readers who live in Vancouver, it will hit home for a lot of them in many ways. Where did the original idea for this book come from?
Well, I started writing it in 2012, which it was around the time of the Opal Commission, you know, the commission for looking into the murdered missing women inquiry. And as that was going on, I was, you know, talking to people who were sort of involved in that, people who had worked in the sex trade or, you know, law enforcement and journalists and people who had, you know, done research on that. And talking to everyone, I was amazed by how much wasn't ending up in the inquiry, how many, you know, voices weren't being heard, and how different the official narrative was from what, you know, what I was hearing. And, you know, I think that that's really where the impetus came from, was just to sort of show what's really going on, or what, you know, people might not be be thinking about.
Well, you bring up a very interesting point because, you know, obviously that commission and that whole case is very well known in Vancouver, but there seems to be a lot that the general public, you know, still don't know. When you were doing research for your book, you know, how much did you discover that you didn't actually know about the case? You know, like what was being said sort of in the media versus what you may have found out that people didn't necessarily want to come out.
Well, I think, you know, the biggest thing for me and really the biggest, point still is that people think of that as, you know, the Picton case, or, you know, like a, they frame it around one serial killer. And, you know, Vancouver has had several killers who targeted the same demographic, the same group, predominantly poor, marginalized people of color who work in the sex trade. So once you're sort of aware of that, it really shifts things away from, you know, the narrative of, you know, it took a long time, but thank God we caught him. Right. That's such an insufficient and, I think really false and damaging way of framing that. So that's really the biggest, point, I think.
So, you know, about the novel, you decided to tell the story through the eyes of a private investigator, Dave Wakeland. What made you decide to go that route in specifically?
Well, there's two things. One, I grew up really loving, you know, the tradition of the detective novel. You know, going back to Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, you know, up to Sue Grafton and Robert B. Parker, and that whole tradition I really love. You know, just in literature, you know, the private eye is a figure that can move through classes and groups in society, and you know, sort of works as someone who can, you know, see into the different social strata. So I really like that, and also I really didn't want to write a police procedural. I thought it was important to, you know, not have the protagonist involved with the police, at least in the story.
You know, given the subject matter of the book, was it easier or harder for you to write about your hometown in a sense?
You know, it's weird. I love Vancouver, and you know, when I started writing the book, I'd finished school, I was working at a college, and I was, you know, just going out and walking around the city and really rediscovering it. And you know, at the same time, doing all this research and sort of seeing what's going on beneath that and how other people see it. So there was a real, you know, ambivalence. And I think that that's what's really in the book, you know, that I do love Vancouver, but it's got some real issues that it hasn't really confronted.
So what I read that was really interesting is that someone just compared you to David Simon. I happen to think that comparison's quite apt given the sort of The Wire-esque type of story that The Invisible Dead is. What does that mean to you to be compared to somebody like him?
Well, we're both bald. Obviously, I love The Wire and, you know, Tremé in the Corner and all of his shows. You know, going back to Homicide, I mean, I grew up as a kid watching Homicide, Life on the Street, and NYPD Blue. And what was so great about those shows is that they showed law enforcement as a job, right? They showed it as, you know, something that can be done well, but something that ultimately is, you know, that's a workplace. And when that idea of a workplace, you know, when that comes into contact with things like poverty or drugs or the sex trade or you know, just the idea of justice, there's a real antagonism between that. And, you know, that's hopefully what I could, you know, put into the book.
Why do you think, you know, issues like the sex trade or a murdered woman, and specifically the case surrounding Vancouver, why do you think people are so uncomfortable in maybe talking about it?
You know, in some ways, I don't think they are uncomfortable with talking about it. I think that everyone sort of has this knowingness of, oh, you know, it's this person's fault, or it's this, you know, and part of it is just getting people to stop and realize that, you know, they actually don't know what's going on, including me. You know, I'm as ignorant as anyone else. So I think that that's really what's important, is just kind of getting people to listen and maybe be more open to another perspective on that.
You know, on that note, like, there's as we said before, there's been so much talked about in this case, you know, from the courts or from the police. But what do you think a fictional perspective can tell us about this story or this case?
Well, that's a good question.
So what do you think a fictionalized perspective can tell us about this case?
Well, I think, you know, narrative is something that we look for in the news, you know, and even if you just look at the stories around, like, movies and movie grosses, you know, that people sort of, if they don't get the narrative from the movie, they're going to create their own, you know, around, you know, whether the movie's a success or not. So, given that we have this kind of desire for narrative and drama, I think it can be really useful to show something on a small scale that can, you know, sort of stand for something bigger. You know, in the book, in Invisible Dead, you know, I just focus on one person, one missing woman. And I hope that that's a way to sort of elucidate some of the issues surrounding that topic in a way that, you know, is interesting and that makes people think, but that doesn't sort of overwhelm them.
Yeah. What do you, I mean, definitely in the last couple of years, we've started having a conversation about missing women or, you know, it, Indigenous and Aboriginal rights. What do you make of how far we've come in terms of addressing those concerns?
Oh man, I mean, I'm not an expert on that. I would just say that I grew up, I'm a product of the BC school system, and you know, I learned nothing about colonialism, First Nations, you know, any of the cultures that were here first. You know, last year, the UBC Museum of Anthropology ran an exhibit called Sesnam, the City Before the City, and it just blew my mind that there is so much you know, we'd never been told. And, you know, to have things like residential school narratives come out, I mean, this is really important stuff. You know, as far as reconciliation, again, like, I'm not someone who would feel comfortable making suggestions and that stuff, but just that it has to start with a respectful education, you know, just of our history. I think, you know, that's important for us, for everyone who lives here.
And, you know, given now that you're an award-winning crime novelist, what maybe nugget of advice would you offer young writers out there, or, you know, sports young people that are interested in sort of the crime fiction?
You know, when I started writing my first book, Last of the Independents, I heard all sorts of perceived wisdom, you know, things like, don't set your books in Canada, don't write about private eyes, don't show violence towards animals, don't put children in danger. And, you know, my first book did all of those things. You know, there's a great piece of advice that the screenwriter William Goldman has, which is, nobody knows anything. you know, everyone who presents themselves as an expert about what people will like, you know, it's always going to be false. What people respond to, I think, is just honesty and good writing. And, you know, whatever that is for you, you just have to go for it. And, you know, don't worry about the money, because there is none.
Well, Invisible Dead is certainly good writing. Sam Weeb, thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you.
Alrighty, I encourage all the listeners, all the readers to go out there and get The Invisible Dead. And Sam's going to be, you have an event on the 6th, I believe. You're going to be at Black Bonds Books in Maple Ridge on the 6th, and then the one Black Bonds in Surrey on the 13th. You can go to samweeb.com for that. Sam Weeb, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ciao. That was my conversation with film director Rob Connolly. Thanks to Rob, C.R. Avery, and Sam Weeb for being on the show today. Stay tuned for Friday when my guests will be Matthew White, Christy Cherish, and Caravan Palace. We're going to take you out with C.R. Avery's Against the World. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Back here again. The streets like water, and that's a mighty river to cross. I can't seem to break these old habits. I've fallen off the wagon, and I'm alone. My mind, hell's fireworks twirl. Whatever happened to you and me against the world? Whatever happened to you and me against the world? Maybe it's the coat check, girl, that keeps giving me the eye. I'm just another guy that wants to keep his options open. Or maybe it's the money. Sometimes that's the case. You get stuck in a bad headspace, slamming doors in. My mind tells fireworks twirl. Whatever happened to you and me against the world? Whatever happened to you and me against the world? Restless feeling. Tonight finds me staring at the ceiling. Every big city has people to make her feel pretty small. Yeah, so this one's for the highway that knows me by my name. It's a goddamn shame. Sometimes love is a long distance. In my mind, hell's fireworks twirl. Whatever happened to you and me against the world? Whatever happened to you and me against the world? Against the world. Against the world.
against